Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name's Kevin. I'm the ACT Fabians convener, and I'd like to welcome you all here today. Before we begin, I'd just like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people of this, the traditional owners of this land, and acknowledge their elders past and present. Today, we have a very exciting speaker. Dr. Lindy Edwards is here to talk to us about her new book, The Passion of Politics. Just very quickly, Dr. Edwards worked as an economic advisor in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. She was a press gallery journalist for the Sydney Morning Herald. She's also been a senior policy advisor to an Australian political party leader. That's all I got from your blurb, unfortunately, Lindy. You couldn't work out which leader was it?
Oh, that was actually to Natasha Stott Despoja.
Nice, too, yep. And after extensive experience in the Australian political system, returned to academia, complete PhD at the Australian National University, now political science.
Yep.
And we're here to hear from Lindy about her new book, The Passion of Politics. I think it's a very exciting book. Don't want to reveal too much about it, so I think we might just throw straight to Lindy to talk about it. Just to very quickly spruik, there are copies available of the book right over there, and she's got it at a good price, only $30. You can even get it signed right now, I believe. Author is
if
in the house.
If you brought a pen.
If you brought without further ado, I think I'll pass it on to Lindy.
All
thanks
right,
very much.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Let's see how I go with the attempts to manage the technology here. Alrighty. When I was sitting down to write this book, or in fact over the process of writing this book, I developed a number of goals. You know, a good publisher, of course, will always tell you that you should have just one goal. But I always find writing a book takes a sufficiently long time that you develop more and more goals as you go along. But basically, I had three goals in setting out to write this book. Firstly, I was wanting to make the biggest ideas in political science accessible, the biggest ideas in political thought. That, you know, in academia there's a tendency, you know, that most of the really big, really important ideas are actually quite simple. But there is a tendency in academia in particular to bury those simple ideas in about 12 feet of gumph. You know, that problem of too many of us whose tenure relies on publishing stuff means that most of these big ideas get buried. And this is, I think, particularly important to the politics of the left, because so many of the ideas that were the driving force of left politics have actually started to get a little bit long in the tooth. They've fallen out of public consciousness, and they're not regularly coming up as accepted wisdom in public debate. So one of the goals, you know, as I say, I'm a firm believer that most of the really important ideas are quite simple ideas. So one of the ideas was to make those ideas accessible and to try and get them back into a little bit of the public circulation and public debate. So this book, I don't know, how many people need undergrad degrees in politics? Not many at all, okay. Well, I was going to say, you know, when you did that undergraduate degree, you know, occasionally, you know, you come out of that lecture and you have one of those brain exploding moments where suddenly you look at the world in quite a different way, that somebody's just explained stuff in a way that makes things seem kind of different. And so, you know, this book, it's actually based on a course that I teach, and my goal was to make sure that pretty much every lecture had one of those brain exploding moments. It was a collection of what I saw as most of the brain exploding moments in politics, in political science. So, goal number one, accessible introduction to some of those big ideas. The second goal of this book was to revive a narrative about Australian political identity, really. That in the height of the Howard years, he succeeded in claiming a particular set of Australian nationalist traditions or nationalist identities that had once upon a time been the possession of the left, which he's remade really as an identity of the right, and that it's been pretty much shred, you know, it's been, what's the word I'm looking for? An awful lot of Australia's most exciting, interesting, and progressively defined history has been left out of it. So one of the things that I was wanting to do was to redefine that sense of Australian political traditions in terms of, you know, reviving that sense, that notion that once upon a time we were sort of, that we were early radical Democrats. That, you know, at the time at which Australia embraced democracy, you know, that we, you know, that democracy was still seen as mob rule by the great unwashed masses by most of Europe at that time. That we had those sort of groundbreaking, you know, that we were groundbreaking in terms of, you know, whether we're talking the 8-hour days and the minimum wages, the roles of trade unions, a whole range of areas of social reform. The idea that we had the world's first ever national Labor government, all that sort of stuff which has fallen out of public consciousness. And in fact, to the degree that I, as somebody who has, you know, a pretty serious political enthusiast from a pretty young age. You know, I did all of the politics subjects that were available at school. I went to uni. I did politics at uni. I went and worked in politics. Came back, did a PhD. And in the course of that, I didn't happen to know about the great strikes. I didn't know the story of any of the Labor splits. I actually didn't know an extraordinary amount of Australia's political history. And what I was really surprised about was I had this vague idea that Australian politics, political history was kind of dull. But it's actually full of cracking yarns. You know, the journalist in me was sitting there going, crikey, how come these stories aren't being told? This is good, fun stuff. And it's also, again, I think really important stuff for a progressive agenda in that if these stories are part of our national stories, our story about ourselves and our story about our past shapes our perceptions of what the future can be. I'm quite confident that if every Australian, when they got up to the footy and sang Waltzing Matilda, were aware of Waltzing Matilda's relationship to the great strikes, there's no way John Howard would have brought in work choices. It would have been too profoundly un-Australian. So I think that this idea of the way that we tell this history is actually also about creating a trajectory and a sense of national identity going forward. And I think this seems particularly important at the moment when politics feels in like such a bloody depressing quagmire at the moment. And the idea of going, hey, actually, we had, you know, we've been great innovators in the past. We've our politics has been exciting and something to be proud of in the past, and it can be again. Is, you know, a part of that story. But really, the main reason that I started writing this book, you know, I often, you know, when I think about when did this book start, to be honest, it started as I carried the contents of my desk past the reflections pool in Parliament House as I was sort of exiting the site of the implosion of the Democrats. As I was trying, because I wanted to work out what it was, given all I'd seen, what it was that I believed in. That it seemed to me that most of the folk up at Parliament House, both, you know, in the Labor and the Dems, didn't really have a particularly clear idea of what it is that they were trying to achieve. That we were using the same sets of ideas to analyse the problems as our opponents, and so surprise, surprise, we were coming up with the same answers. So I wasn't clear what it was we were fighting for, and also given some of the things I'd seen, I wasn't entirely sure if I believed in it anymore. So the big part, you know, a huge part of this project was this process of going, right, what I want to do is I want to pull out the big ideas, I want to look at how they worked out in practice. I'm not, you know, don't care terribly, you know, it's not just, you know, is this a fabulous, lovely, shiny idea in principle, but actually when we've gone and mucked around with these ideas, how did they work, to work out what exactly it was that I believed in. So that's really kind of what the book's about. So where did we tell you a little bit about where I got to on this? Now, I wasn't entirely sure who'd be in the audience, so there's a little bit of stuff here that I'll move through quickly, which is probably of more interest to an academic audience. But anyway, now, you might think that this idea of going back and looking at the big ideas and looking at how they worked out in practice would be the bread and butter of the study of politics. That, you know, you should roll off into a university, you should be able to study that, and surely that's, you know, if you're going to get something out of an undergrad politics degree, you'd expect that might be it. In fact, no. In fact, ideology has actually really fallen out of being studied. You know, it's no longer really a subject of serious academic study. To the degree that I went to sign on to a conference, the Midwestern Political Science Association conference in the US next year. It's an enormous conference. It's one of those 7,000 delegates kind of conference. It has 75 sub-discipline groups all studying different specialist aspects of politics, and not one of those groups has ideology in the title, and not one of them is dedicated to studying contemporary political ideology. So this meant that this task I was interested in actually didn't fall into mainstream politics. It didn't fall into the work that was being done. And I want to explain why. Now, depending on your political background and your age and a few other things, you've probably got a different set of assumptions about what ideology means. And of course, there's been a number of different sort of concepts of it. That, you know, the first sort of classic Marxist concept of ideology is as a set of beliefs that legitimates the status quo and which enlists the oppressed in being complicit in their own oppression. So it's a set of ideas that elites come up with which makes the existing sort of way of organising things, appear natural and reasonable and something that the poor and the marginalised tolerate. So that's sort of, you know, the Marxist understanding of it. Sort of through the 50s and 60s, there was quite a different liberal conception of ideology, which was basically that it was the Marxists who were ideologists. And so their take on ideology was that it was a set of abstract theoretical ideas about how the world should work, come up with by intellectuals, that had no bearing on the practicalities of how life actually works. And that sort of a notion was particularly being targeted at the big progressive experiments at the time, pointing out what they saw as the folly of these big sort of progressive movements being driven by these abstract ideas. So sort of hopefully here at this point you're starting to get a sense of ideology is effectively the ideas of somebody you disagree with. But, you know, in terms of the difficulty I encountered studying this stuff, the problem started really when, you know, the next wave of thinking about ideology hit and the death knell for the study of ideology came from two directions. Firstly, you had sort of the rise of postmodernism and constructivism, which ran around and basically started to equate ideology with culture, and ideology with cultural beliefs. And part of this notion was this idea that actually every person has a slightly different set of belief systems, that we're all getting lots and lots of different stories and lots of different ideas and we're combining them in new ways, and actually everybody has a slightly different understanding of how the world is. So it actually doesn't make sense to talk about, you know, the whole, you know, that traditional conception of ideologies, which was, you know, the grand theory of everything that tells you how the world works. And they sort of start to go, look, the idea that there's a grand theory of everything that whole groups of people can sign on to is rubbish, that really we're all creating our own realities. And, you know, so, you know, you had that sort of an argument coming from the folk who did believe ideas were important, and from the other side of, you know, the other side of the fence, you had a bunch of folk running around, you know, sort of doing behavioralist studies that argued, that people, you know, voters, didn't have a coherent set of beliefs and values that drove their voting, and that, you know, ideas and values weren't actually very important in how people voted. So the impact of those two things meant that as far as politics as an academic discipline went, ideology kind of dissolved. It ceased to be something that you could meaningfully study. And this is despite the fact, this sort of creates that fascinating thing. How many of you guys have been bombarded by information, you know, by stuff on Facebook? How many Facebook users? Who's liked being liberal? All right, nobody. Okay. If you're being bombarded by paraphernalia from the US elections, the extent to which clearly they assume that your values are deeply important in driving how you vote. You know, it's like, you know, if you believe in this, then you'll vote this way. If you, you know, if you believe in that, then you'll vote the other way. That very clearly their campaigns are very strongly centred on these issues of ideology and values, and yet the biggest political science one of the biggest political science conferences in the US won't be talking about that at all. None of the 6,000 delegates. So that's, but I'm going to go off the basis that maybe academia is wrong and maybe my Facebook account is more accurate. Sacrilege, I know. Nonetheless, it's not entirely straightforward to pin down ideologies. Firstly, you know, if you are trying to discern, you know, different sets of ideologies, there's a whole bunch of problems in doing that. Firstly, that when you look, you know, when we look back historically, we look at these different sets of ideas, we discover that basically, of course, most schools of thought emerged in response to the particular crises of their time, and they were in direct reactions to the very particular challenges that their societies were facing. And that if you look at, you know, if you look at variants of socialism or liberalism or whatever, you'll actually find that, you know, every small locality across Europe, in fact, had a different understanding of what those things were. So they tended to be specific to very particular moments in time, they changed over time, they were geographically specific, and of course there's multiple strands, you know, the level of different sub-discipline, you know, subgroups with different views is of course pervasive. So that makes pinning it down exactly what 90 starts to make the postmodernists look a little bit right, which is a bit annoying. But that makes that a bit tricky. The other thing which then becomes a bit tricky is how you then apply it to current politics. That firstly, because the old ideas were targeted, you know, they did sort of come out of the great challenges of their times, how relevant are they to current debates? You know, how relevant, throw up a controversial one, how relevant are Marx's ideas of class in a world in which human capital has become so important? Or, you know, the worker, definitions and identities around class, etc. Second thing is that these days, you know, as our political debate is more fast and furious, we're receiving much, much more information, and debate is revolving around very specific policy issues. And of course, they're not the policy issues that people were talking about when they were talking about this stuff a long time ago. And finally, lots of policy issues cross national boundaries, and traditionally, the old stories of ideologies tended to focus on how you organise a particular country or how you organise a nation state. So the idea that some policy issues cross boundaries again means that our old conception of ideologies can be kind of tricky to work out how they might apply. Nonetheless, going by gut instinct, I'm picking that if you spot a liberal idea, you can probably, you know, somebody, there's probably a bunch of stuff where you can go, yeah, that's a liberal idea. You hear it, you're pretty sure that that's a free market liberal idea, whether it's, you know, how coupons, you know, privatisation of various systems or carbon trading systems or whatever. We know, you know, we identify these things as liberal ideas. So that gut instinct, you know, that gut instinct that we all have, that we actually are able to distinguish that there is some kind of basis of these differences between left and right, you know, we've got that gut instinct that it's there, but it's a little bit hard to pin down. And the easiest ones to identify, of course, are liberal ideas. But it's actually pretty difficult when you start to get to that notion of what's the crux of social democratic ideas. You know, in the wake of a sort of, in a post-communist world, what is the connecting or the defining set of ideas at the crux of social democratic thinking? Most of us would associate the liberation movements with the left. What on earth has that got to do with the collective ownership of the means of production and that sort of stuff? So what's the crux? And for social democracy, and similarly, a similar sort of problem comes up with conservatism. That, you know, lots of people actually these days will turn around and go, wow, you know, conservative just means you like stuff the way it is, and that, you know, in Russia a conservative is somebody that wants to go back to communism, and, you know, conservatism just means you don't embrace social change. Except, of course, that when the Americans go into Iraq, we call them neocons. And that's a deeply not conservative activity to go and bring democracy to Iraq. That somehow, you know, when you look at something like the Northern Territory intervention, we kind of know that's not a deeply social democratic thing to do. There's a gut feeling that that's kind of down the neocon sort of end. So how do we get to it then? My approach to it was that I went back and I looked at the evolution of these different sets of ideologies. And the way the book works is what it does is it introduces a big set of ideas, and then it looks at how those ideas transformed Australia at the time they became powerful. And so it looks at the evolution of different sets of ideas and then how they worked out in practice. But what I do is I look at each of those sets of ideas is I'm looking for their really deep-seated assumptions. That, you know, it's like clearly looking at the details of the policy debates not going to get us terribly far. But looking at their really enduring assumptions about human nature, about how it is that you get people to, how it is that you get people to act in a coordinated way that makes a complex society work. So this, you know, how do you coordinate a society? How do you achieve order? And this notion of ideals of the good. And one of these things that was quite interesting was that, you know, I went through a few evolutions, and you look at sort of the, you know, outside an Australian context, you know, this battle of ideologies has kind of been kicking on for about 300 years. But we've actually really only got three ideas about different ways of solving this problem. Or, you know, different sets of ideas. Particularly here, the really interesting thing is this. Sorry, I've called it coordination on the other slide and order on this one. Sorry. Okay. Oh, crap, sorry. All right. But basically, when you're looking at these really deep assumptions, we really keep coming back to three pretty basic ideas about how it is that you can make human societies work. And they do tend to be premised on this very different, you know, on different takes on human nature. So, you know, you start off down at the conservative end, which tends to take the view that human nature is flawed, that we're selfish, we're greedy, we're not terribly moral and we're not terribly rational. And as a result, we're really reliant on society and social norms to guide us on how to live. That these ideas, of course, were, you know, they were first advocated by Edmund Burke when he was defending, you know, really the system of the British monarchy and the British hierarchy against the challenge of the French Revolution. But his, you know, and his argument was that the revolution would cause French society to collapse. That he argued that, that people, you know, because we're greedy and we're selfish and we don't actually always know what the consequences of our actions are. We actually need a whole set of social norms which tells us how to live and how to behave.
Sorry.
No input.
Is it function key and...
It's a little bit disturbing that it went off by itself.
Do you have a power cable? We can try
that. Oh, that'll be the problem. It's a battery. Sorry, I forgot. Anyway, while that one comes back. You know, so your classic sort of contemporary example of that sort of a identity-based argument would be the argument that we've just seen around gay marriage. So, you know, that, you know, sort of a fairly classic sense of identity roles is the notion that men and women have very different roles in our society, that we should... Oops.
If the state doesn't stop us, people will marry their pets.
That's right. And that idea that... That's not very good. Anyway, we'll pretend it's not happening.
Bottom right hand corner.
There we go. Okay, so, you know, so for example, in the gay marriage debate, you sort of saw quite strongly those concerns coming out that, you know, that if there's not a dad there to teach the little boy how to be a man, goodness, he mightn't work it out, that he needs to be enculturated into a set of norms and behaviours, otherwise society will go to hell in a handbag. You know, he might think he should, like, do the cooking and the dishes or something. you know, so that notion that you need a clear set of cultural norms, which tells people, you know, tells people how to live, what their role is, how they fit in, etc. And, you know, and the ideals associated with that notion of the good were, of course, order and stability and actually being part of a coherent cultural meaning system, which is actually not an insignificant issue. So we'll come back to that one. That was contrasted to the liberal view, of course, which is that notion that, you know, people are individuals, that we're reasonably rational, or, you know, and that we're the best judge of our own happiness. That notion that we're the best judge of our own happiness, and we're certainly a better judge of our own happiness than the local lord. And that notion that the way that society works is through a dispersed system of, you know, a dispersed system. Basically, if you've got all of these equal, rational people who are the best judge of their own happiness engaging in voluntary exchanges or voluntary agreements with people. Presumably, if you've got two equal rational people and they agree to do something together, that's going to be to their mutual benefit, and you know, the leap was then made that that would be to the good of all, and that this was basically a very dispersed system of natural liberty. The idea that because people were sufficiently rational to be able to make decisions in their own interests, that this individualistic society in which people made decisions about their own lives would be a better way of organising society. And then you sort of have the third kind of logic of order, or the third way, which, the sort of the third mechanism that comes up a lot, which is basically the notion of the collective deliberation of shared rules. You know, the sort of social democratic kind of framework tends to also see people as being reasonably rational and as capable of making reasoned just judgments about what's going to advance their own well-being. The difference is that it sees the social context as being much more important. It tends to argue that if people aren't of reasonably equal levels of power in a social context, then you're not actually effectively free. And so this notion of collective deliberation on shared rules, where maintaining the legitimacy of the rules requires treating people justly. That the moment you start to treat people unjustly, cooperation breaks down and the system, and it stops working as a form of order. So it was kind of interesting. So, you know, to be honest, these things change a little bit. But these three ideas, you know, we've had the whole sort of collective intelligence of the Western world been pondering this stuff for 300 years, and we really only came up with three ideas. So helpful. Oops. Okay. And previous. And previous. Ah, no. I've got the wrong form of it. I'm sorry, I made some edits. And with the computer crashing, I've lost these edits. Which is a little bit annoying, actually. I wonder if... One second. Sorry, the slide I've lost talks about the pros and cons, and particularly the particular problems associated with each of these forms of order. And one of the reasons, actually, you know, one of the reasons for telling this story historically is some of these ideas sound kind of silly when they're introduced to you in the abstract, or not very important, or something. Like, I remember the first time I was these liberal ideas were, you know, social contract theory was explained to me without any, you know, this sort of, these liberal ideas, without any historical context at all, and people sort of said, you know, isn't that an incredibly stupid set of ideas? And I went, well, sort of, yeah. But when they put it in the context of the challenge against monarchy, suddenly you're like, yeah, you're right. No, people mightn't be perfectly rational, but they can still be a better judge of their interests than the local, you know, than the local authorities. So, you know, one of the reasons for telling these stories historically is actually each of these ideas did emerge initially in response to a major crisis, in which there were a really powerful, compelling set of ideas about why it was a good idea. They also all develop problems. And the historical example also really clearly highlights what those problems are. Some of this might seem kind of obvious, but because we actually often don't look at ourselves very critically, I'll talk a little bit about what those problems are. As you might expect, down the conservative end of the problem, you know, the conservative sort of a way of organising things. Firstly, you know, your biggest problem with abuses of power is the notion that these elites who are, you know, these elites whose job it is to ensure that other people conform to their social roles and who govern this hierarchy might abuse that power at the top of that hierarchy. And that you get great discrepancies between rich and poor, and you have elites abusing their power. In terms of things that matter to folk, so it's, you've got that elite risk of abuse of power. You don't have very much autonomy and freedom, that you get shunted into a role and you've pretty much got to go off and do your role, and if that's not what you want to do, that can be an issue. It's not terribly just. Clearly. Other issues and issues that come out, you know, very evidently in the examples, you know, in which the, you know, these ideas were first written, is firstly about its rigidity, of how slowly it adapts to change, that because, you know, we develop a set of cultural norms about how people are supposed to behave in a situation, and we embed it really deeply in their identities, rather than just being the practical solution to the problem. So if the problem changes, people aren't that likely to change their behaviour. You know, and I think sort of, you know, a really classic example of that would be something like sort of Christian norms around morality around sex. That you sit there and you kind of go, look, you know, pre-contraception, the idea that you might bring a child into the world that couldn't be provided for is a pretty seriously not good idea. You know, the idea that you're going to have, you know, that would be seen as a very serious wrong to bring a child into the world that, you know, that can't be provided for. You can sort of see how that's, you know, that's a pretty serious problem. And so instead of having a set of ideas which went, you know, the problem is bringing children into the world that can't be provided for, the idea was that sex is bad, that everybody should just avoid having sex. And so when sort of, you know, when contraception became widely and freely available, and the whole sort of, the political, you know, the social consequences of having sex in a variety of contexts, you know, the social consequences of that changed, but the moral norms around sex have changed much more slowly. But there's that sort of a rigidity. The other issue is that it also can't cope with any form of cultural diversity. That, you know, the notion that everybody's got to be signing on to a single set of norms, and the moment that you have people signing on to different norms, things mightn't work out that well. And again, you know, the historical example of that, that one of the reasons when, you know, when sort of monarchy first came under that sort of really serious challenge was because there was a whole bunch of religious conflict in Europe at the time between the Catholics and the Protestants, and, you know, the belief systems at the time were very much based on a sort of a set of religious beliefs, and the idea that you then couldn't have two, you know, you couldn't have peoples with different religions living next to each other because they had different norms. So, string of problems. Okay, we have time, so we'll go a little bit faster. Okay, the liberal sort of approach. Similarly, I should say all of these forms of order are all subject to abuses of power. They're actually all vulnerable to being, you know, to having significant abuses of power. And of course, the liberal one is the notion that a sort of a system of voluntary exchanges creates a rich get richer, poor get poorer dynamic. That people aren't coming together to negotiate as equals, that the moment that one person is wealthier or has more power, they're able to bring that level of power to any sort of negotiation they might be part of, and as a result they're going to get be able to accrue greater advantage from it. So that notion that the more power you have, the more money you have, the more you're able to ensure that negotiations go your way. And similarly, the less power you have, the less money you have, the less scope you have to make agreements go your way. So that notion of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. So it's subject to that form of abuse of power, not terribly good on justice as a consequence of that, and not terribly good on meaning systems as a consequence, or as part of this mechanism as well. That notion that you've got individuals doing very much their own thing, you don't necessarily have a coherent, you don't necessarily have a shared belief system. Finally, the social democrat, the collective deliberation on shared rules. Also, pretty clearly subject to some kind of significant challenges. Firstly, you know, the great risk of the collective deliberation on shared rules is, of course, the idea that a small subgroup ends up dominating the deliberative process, and then everybody is bound by the shared rules, which actually only a small group actually had control over making. So that notion that a small group of interests is able to dominate what's supposed to be a collective process, but everybody is then bound by those collective rules. Secondly, that notion that you give up a fair bit of autonomy, that pretty challenging to come up with collective rules that deal with every variation and situation, and as a result, you're inevitably going to end up being bound. You know, that there's that sort of scope for constraint. Another problem with the collective deliberation on shared rules is how you decide who's insiders and who's outsiders. Who's part of the collective deliberation and who's bound by the rules and who's excluded. And of course, you know, you have histories of things like the White Australian policy which highlight that kind of a notion pretty strongly. You also, particularly when you start to get into liberation movements type stuff, collective deliberation on shared rules across different meaning systems is also kind of, can also, you know, lends itself to a level of cultural relativism. So, I think that sort of a framework for me sort of raises a whole bunch of questions for progressive politics, and questions that play out around, you know, examples that sort of play out in the book around this sort of stuff is how, for example, we deal, you know, where the left stands on things like the way the tariff protection system in Australia ended up panning out, that you had a system that was initially put in place to to protect vulnerable and particularly working people from the excesses of markets and from unfair competition, a system that became corrupted. Lots of us look at the loss of that system as a great loss of the left, that, you know, the end of protection and the rise of neoliberalism was a pretty nasty thing. So this notion of kind of going, well, you know, I think I should be pointing out, you know, that one of the steps I've sort of perhaps leapt here is this notion of going, so in this kind of a framework, you know, a political battle is actually, you know, politics is really a struggle about which of these logics, the relative predominance of these different logics of order in organising society, that society always uses a mix of them. But the questions of which ones are relatively more predominant or relatively less, you know, how big should government and the collective deliberation on the common good be versus how big should markets be? How strong should the role of, say, a Christian morality or an Australian national identity sort of set of cultural beliefs be, or how loose should those ideas be? So it's about, sorry, our political battles are about the relative weight, you know, the relative role of these different forms of order in society and which problems they should be applied to. You know, you might, for example, you know, in fact, there are many who, for example, are thoroughly liberal in terms of their view on markets, but much less so on their views of multiculturalism. So that notion of going, so which problems do we apply which set of ideas to? So I know this sounds kind of abstract, and unfortunately it just all gets too long if I build the examples into it, but that notion of going, that actually we can look at a huge variety of issues, enormous number of the issues that are the subject of political contest, and you can see these different, you know, that the different sides are lining up using one of these logics of order or the other. And thinking about, I guess it's questions to think about as we think about those specific policy issues. Cooperative compacts again, sorry, it's a different word to the one on the last slide. But where does the collective deliberation on the common good forms of order work and work well? You know, and I think real questions there around things such as how big can government get and have people still feel that it's the collective deliberation on the common good and not a state that's very much at arm's length from them. At what levels does cooperative, you know, at what levels does this collective deliberation on the common good work best? In what system, what situations does it fail, and what protections do we put in place when it does fail? I'm sure that, you know, enough of us here have been involved in enough community and political groups to know that the collective deliberation on shared rules can get pretty sticky. That actually, you know, it's not quite as much goodness and light, and it doesn't necessarily work out that well all the time. So how do you, you know, what protections do you put in place? What levels, you know, what sorts of situations do you apply them to? Oops. And look, when I first sort of started doing this kind of stuff, you know, and I was looking at these critiques of that sort of social democratic model, and I couldn't help but sort of thinking, you know, that old saying about, you know, being a lefty when you're younger and as you get older, that you move to the right as you get a little bit more, you know, that you get sort of more realistic about how stuff works. And I feared of, you know, looking at my sort of deep social democratic roots, and I looked at my increasing jadedness about how well the collective deliberation on the common good works, and I was sort of kind of going, oh, you know, is this me having that moment? But I'd like to think that it's actually about, it's developing a much more open-eyed and pragmatic understanding of that process, of it as a form of order. But I would argue that the fact that the collective deliberation on the common good has a relatively prominent place in Western societies is actually been the basis of this, of the Western ascendancy. That this relatively short period in which Western society has been more powerful than others, it's really not because there's not enough self-interest and competition in other societies. My experience of looking at, you know, that when one looks at, you know, the, you know, I sort of, you know, I've got kind of vivid recollections of, you know, when I was a youngster sitting at, you know, a UN forum and chatting to delegates from Africa, and they were kind of like, oh, you know, how do you, you know, we were talking about how you deal with some public health problem or other, and I was just saying, oh, we just do this, and they just looked at me with that kind of odd madness of how on earth do you get people to agree and go along with, you know, a national health system or systems of that nature. And I remember having a very similar conversation with a Russian work colleague of my dad's, and I remember, you know, in one of those sort of, you know, those kind of, my dad used to work in Russia, and he had this Russian delegation out, you know, and I was, you know, a youngster at uni at the time, you know, full of tremendous self-importance and thought that the Russian delegation thought was terribly important. They heard about the Hex struggle. And, you know, but, you know, I told them how the, you know, how the early Hex system worked. And again, that sense of, wow, that's actually, a remarkably sensible, considered just solution to a problem. We were talking about, it was a level of changes. But anyway, but that notion, you know, back in the days when you only paid it if you actually went on to make a significant amount of money. But they, you know, he was, you know, that notion, again, of going, of actually coming up with effective collective solutions to problems, that when we go through and we look at which societies function well and which ones don't, it's actually about that ability to do the collective deliberation and the common good. And, of course, you know, high levels of trust and cooperativeness are sort of your strongest markers of economic growth. So, or, you know, of sort of wealth. So, on the one, so there's a fair, there's a bit of doom and gloom. There's a bit of, you know, these ideas aren't that shiny in one way, but actually I tend to think that the collective deliberation and the common good is actually the most fragile and the most prone to failure of the three forms of order. I think it's the least stable. But I also think that, you know, it's kind of a remarkable thing that it's been as stable and effective as it's been. And as I say, I think that's been the basis of a lot of Western success. How are you going? You up for another idea or not really?
Yeah, finish it off.
All right. Other challenges for thinking about left stuff, which comes out of the book. One of the things that it looks at is what it takes for an idea to become powerful. What it takes for an idea to not just be a fancy thing that a scribbler came up with as seeming like a bright, shiny, good idea, but actually an idea that social movements take up that become politically powerful. And I think in this time when we're needing renewal, we actually need to think not just about what might be a nice idea, but what might be a nice idea that gets support. And, you know, and it came across, you know, it was really kind of interesting looking at sort of, you know, there's stuff actually the ancient Greeks, when talking about the power of political rhetoric, they identified these basic elements, and actually it really hasn't changed very much in the last several thousand years. That for a political idea to be effective, it needs to have these four elements. It needs to be able to explain key features of people's lived experience. It needs to be consistent with their existing beliefs. It needs to serve their interests. And it needs to appeal to a notion of the good. And if you can come up with a set of ideas that does all of those things, then there's a fair chance that people will buy into it and go along with it. And if it doesn't do all of those things, it's not, it's not necessarily going to win support. And this really strikes me as quite a significant challenge, because one of the things I've been thinking about is just trying to work out this issue of where it is, of how it is in contemporary society we build a base of mass support for whom social justice is in their interests, and particularly the broad notion of social justice as we're exploring it today. But, you know, I think there's lots of scribblers who can come up with this one, terribly good at appealing to notions of the good. You know, we can do these ones as well, but this notion of needing ideas which also hook into, you know, which march an agenda forward where you're not just simply looking at social, you know, there's a certain number of us who will get out there and go to great lengths on, you know, views that social justice is important even when it's not in our interests. But to actually secure a level of mass support, you actually do need to be able to convince people it's in their interests. And there's two real challenges in that, which are probably, you know, probably quite familiar to you. But firstly, the notion of the changing economic structure. The notion, you know, I sort of, having a tendency to, you know, looking at some of this stuff in a historical context, I can't help but wonder whether or not the age of social democracy really was a product of the intersection of a particular set of social forces at that moment in history, and actually pretty tricky to work out how to continue it. And that notion that here, of course, the changing nature of the economic structure, that we've gone from a situation where, you know, when we look through the early part of the 1900s, at the times when unions were at their most powerful, when you had mass production, mass manufacturing, a mass workforce, where you had significant numbers, a very significant proportion of the population in a fairly similar set of economic circumstances and able to be organised. That the way that with technology, that economic structure is changing quite radically. That whole notion that we've gone from having, that increasingly these days the median worker is having a radically different life experience to the person in the bottom 10%. That, you know, that 50 years ago that wasn't the case. That, you know, 50 years ago the person who was the median was having a pretty, you know, could look at the person on the skids and go there, but for the grace of God. And that's not so much the case. So this issue of, you know, that there's all of these sort of wonderful opportunities for social democracy being created by these new technologies, but that change in the economic structure creates this real challenge of how it is that you get your median voter to give two hoots about the people in the bottom 10%. The second difficulty in this sort of building a mass base is this notion that the splintering of, you know, that the battle for justice, again, you know, if we look 50 or 60 years ago, it was really only occurring on one dimension. It was very much about economic equality between men. That the liberation movements in one sense can be seen as part of a sort of a fairly, sort of a long historical process in which basically who comes under the umbrella of human equality has slowly expanded. That, you know, the first time that people talked about citizen equality, they were talking about citizens who made up less than 0.5% of the British, you know, of the British elite. And then, you know, slowly they changed the property entitlements of who counted as equal, and then slowly that, then they took the property entitlements away, and then it was sort of all white men. And sort of through the 60s and 70s, we then started to go, and women and people of other races. But of course, it creates that difficulty that particularly the white blokes for whom the struggle for economic equality was very much in their interests, actually, the struggle for equality of other races and of women isn't necessarily in their interests, actually. You know, there's sort of sometimes, I think people sometimes look at that set of attitudes and go, oh, you know, it's an issue of education or whatever, when actually it's really a pretty straight interests issue of kind of going, if you're in a position where historically you've been in a position of privilege above women and above people of other races, there is actually a loss of power and privilege in accepting the equality of those groups. So this notion that now social democrats, well, you know, those of us who are going to do it on a principled level of the idea of equality, you know, all good, but if you're actually looking at it in terms of organising interests, again, it's quite difficult to work out how you're going to build this mass, because actually they've got, you know, you've got a number of different justice battles going on, and it's not necessarily, that in the same way that I'm sure Alan Joyce would very much have liked to have seen the gay marriage legislation go through, he's not necessarily seeing the equity and justice issues with his union workers. Similarly, there are others, you know, who'll be holding a banner for other forms of greater levels of equality, who, you know, aren't that interested in the equality of other groups. So that's probably the more depressing note to end on, but I think we're out of time. So I'll do that.
Well, round of applause, please. And maybe just...
Please. Yeah? Oh, that's right. Don't exist.
Is it okay, time for just a quick question?
Yeah.
Perhaps if I could begin. I was very interested in your framework of conservative, liberal, social democratic, the idea that perhaps political parties in Australia draw on all three. I was just wondering from your thought space as a former Democrat, do you think the Liberals are too conservative? Do you think the Labor Party is too conservative, too liberal? Do you think the Greens, where do the Greens fit in? Are they too... I'm not sure where.
I mean, I think that sort of transformation that we've really seen since the 1980s is we've seen that significant shift of Labor towards a much more liberal position. And then we've seen the Liberals, the Liberals becoming conservative. That, you know, Menzies would have been to the left of...
Yeah. Probably of, Malcolm Fraser.
Absolutely. So that whole notion that that part of the impact of the the economic reforms of the 80s is that the whole political spectrum shunted to the right, and that notion of I would argue that one of the reasons that the Democrats imploded was that because when it was formed in the 1970s, they were centrists. You know, that they were pitting themselves between big labour and big business. But over the course of the 1980s, the whole political spectrum moved so far to the right that by holding on to the same policy positions, they were now on the far left. And you had this difficulty that you had different generations within the party who actually agreed on the same policy positions but had really different perceptions of their political identity. That you had old-style Democrats who saw themselves often as breakaways from the Liberal Party and saw themselves as quite moderate centrists, and you had young Democrats who saw themselves as radical lefties. And really the reason the party imploded was it failed to resolve that conflict.
That's perhaps an omen for the ALP, but that's another question. Any questions from the floor?
Just a comment. There are some new ideas around, and I don't know if you've come across them, but there's a new revival of institutionalism by Geoffrey Hodgson. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. But, I think it ties in with some of your ideas. I think you mentioned another time the compulsory voting in Australia and the effects that had. His idea is societies exist within particular frameworks of particular rules and regulations, and they behave within that. And there's another idea that's also that's come out from a different direction, and that's probably partly from biology, and that is self-organisation. Is that, you provide the context and provide a group of individuals who behave in a certain way and leave them to themselves, and they're basically self-organised. You can see that in certain contexts. You see it on roads where all the service stations will set up, if they're left to themselves, there's no regulation, they'll all set up in the same sort of position. Fast food outlets, the same thing. You can provide a context and things will self-organise. And I think there's a lot to be said for societies doing just that within their particular context of rules and regulations.
I would actually tend to see that, actually. I tend to see that notion of society operating within those rules and regulations, but that's operating kind of on that conservative model, that notion that we're all bounded I should emphasise...
Is it more social democratic in your social democratic framework, though? It really applies in both ends, doesn't it?
Well, to the extent that which set of actually which set of mechanisms you use is in itself a cultural norm. That notion that, you know, we know that, you know, there's particular groups that whenever they get together, they'll sit down and they'll do that collective deliberation on the common good sort of thing. And there are other groups who, whenever they get together, half the audience will sit back and the three people who always do organise everything will do it. You know.
Like an ALP meeting.
You know, the different groups have their norms and their norms as well. You know, so which form of order you use is actually a norm. And, I think that notion of saying that the political battle is actually a battle about the relative prominence of these different sets of ideas, that actually, I actually hope it's one of the things that comes out in the book, is that actually there's an element of truth and usefulness to all of them, that they actually, all three of them should be a part of the mix, and it is an argument about how strong the mix should be. And in terms of self-organising systems, I think Adam Smith thoroughly agrees.
I'd like to ask you if you consider yourself to be an optimist or a pessimist, because from reading the book, I suspect you're an optimist, and I don't mean that as a criticism at all, but one message I get is that, as you said, ideology remains a key driver of politics just up the hill there, and the pessimistic reading of it is it's all focus groups and opinion polls and the media cycle, that is, you know, more of a core policy determinant. But as you see it, it's still ideology that, and ideas and values.
I guess two things. I mean, I think that the ideas and values, clearly we've got, I think the level of public frustration with the debate at the moment is actually because it's being so driven by the focus groups, that it's really transparent that that's how it's operating, and that's why both parties are on the nose. And I think that when you look at our most successful leaders, and whether you're talking Howard or Keating or Hawke, that they have actually had much more coherent narratives. And it wasn't an immediate focus, it wasn't a focus group thing. But I'd actually throw it back at you the other way, and I actually don't know if it's a terribly... I'm not sure that it's an optimistic... I'm pleased you think it's an optimistic book. I'm not entirely sure that it was. That's not necessarily what I thought. But is that I'd actually suggest, I'd actually... throw the question back the other way and actually ask whether or not democracy can function without ideologies. Mm-hmm. That actually, that because we need to be able, we need that process of being able to organise people into groups that are able to make meaningful decisions between options. And that the options over the relative weight of those principles is about the level of complexity the system can actually cope with. And if people actually group on different bases, I was recalling a paper being given by a colleague of mine at one stage who was talking about sort of various disasters with democratic experiments in parts of the Pacific where people were voting on ethnic lines. And that notion that actually that means there's not a swing between elections, that there's actually no room for movement or compromise or policy development, that actually if people aren't organising and voting around principles of governance, there's a question about whether or not, the democratic political systems can function, I think.
Do you think we need to rehabilitate the word self, perhaps? Like there's a certain... It's pejorative. Like if it's used in the political context here in Canberra, it's always, like you said, ideology is something other people do, and someone's described as a right-wing ideologue or a left-wing ideologue. And perhaps the reason it wasn't at that conference over in the States is that people are scared of it, or the word itself. I don't know if the word can be reclaimed, because it's not a bad word at all.
Yeah, I don't think it should be a bad word, but absolutely, it's got a really bad reputation.
People talk about values, they just don't talk about ideology.
Yeah, but
we all want values and vision and are all terrified of ideology. Yeah.
And, they keep wanting, in the current political context, the government seems to be trying to establish a narrative by simply saying everything we do is a labour reform. And therefore imbuing it with a certain kind of value.
I was just going to remark that ideology was made a bad word from the beginning by Marx and his friends. Before that, it simply meant psychology. It was the Napoleonic era, French version.
I think it was actually Napoleon who was the first to use it as a derogatory term. But
well, because he didn't like these people. What I'd like to say about your general approach is that it seems to me to be somewhat idealistic, in the sense that politics has been professionalised. And a lot of the professionals are simply careerists, and they reach for ideas, like ancient rhetoricians reached for topics. They're weapons. They don't care whether they're true or false. They don't care whether they're consistent in the positions they take up. Now, I think that democracy has been a big disappointment to many people. I think maybe people on the left should focus on some of the institutional things that Kevin was talking about, especially on our political and electoral system. We should really focus on getting some discipline over the behaviour of these political professionals from ordinary non-professional people with interest in politics. It's the non-professionals, people like yourself and me, who are interested in the ideas and the ideas of the good and bringing about a just order and that kind of thing. The political professionals are interested in winning. We've got to make sure that to win, they have to take these ideas seriously.
Well, I must admit that's part of, that's in fact part of one of the things that the book was seeking to do, was actually hoping to get a range of people just talking in these terms. And even the fact, a lot of first-year politics textbooks actually don't include any discussion of ideas. They only talk systems. So that notion of going, part of what we need to be doing is actually giving people a language to go, hey, these issues are actually quite important, and they do actually really shape the fabric and culture of the society. And there's an interesting conversation to be having here and to be demanding it. I mean, I think half the problem, we've got two sets of problems on the Hill. One is the careerist politicians, and can anybody confirm this for me? My suspicion is that we are currently having our first experience of having two people who were student politicians being leaders of opposition parties, leading both of the parties.
Paul Keating was a student leader too, though.
But was he?
No, he wasn't. He was a young Labour guy, though, surely, wasn't he?
He was a young Labour guy.
Oh, but he was a student politician. Okay. Here we go.
Because, on the one hand, it is really dire at the moment, and yet on the other hand, I think, for everything that one disagrees with about his views, John Howard had a very clear values agenda. And, that notion of going, values aren't important because right at this moment there's none. The most sort of recent successful political leader, I would suggest, I think there was an awful lot of stuff saying Howard was very poll-driven. I don't think that's particularly true. I think he had a very particular view of the world, which he pursued pretty consistently over time. And I think that, and I suspect that if you were to ask an awful lot of voters out there at the moment who disliked Howard and disagreed with his worldview, would you prefer him as Prime Minister, or would you prefer the shenanigans that are going on at the moment? I actually think there's an awful lot of people who are kind of going, look, I'd prefer somebody who's doing, who just doesn't say, the problem with the focus group thing is everybody just looks corrupt. It really makes people look utterly fickle. And that there's, that Howard, even if you disagreed with his view of the good, you had a sense that he was enacting what he saw as the good. And I think the problem at the moment is that nobody thinks that either of the political leaders are particularly pursuing a view of the good, or that the good is, you know, terribly high on their agenda.
But when you get away from camp, you get a different view. So I was away in the state for a cousin's funeral on the 23rd of June 2010. Anyway, there's a news flash that the challenge was on or whatever. So people in the state seem to think everybody from Canberra is a mayor, but a junkie. And we'd all have a deal and all those sorts of things. So they were asking me, and I said, he's finished. The public, if the public service had anything to do with it, they would have knifed him before this. They're all a bit shocked by this anyway. So we all know what happened. So the next day, these people were absolutely shocked that, you know, the Prime Minister has been voted out by his own wife. And then they asked me what I thought. And I said, oh, well, the King's dead, long live the King, next. And they said, oh, but he's the Prime Minister. And I said, he was the Prime Minister. So it was then, you know, when you wake up, it's an interesting view that people had, that it was almost like it couldn't be changed until the next election. I know it's an unusual thing, but they were the sort of views that sort of come across, that there was a bit of a shock.
They don't understand the mechanism.
No, I know.
No, but it's also the mechanisms that are irrelevant. It's people's values and the way in which they embrace the particular concept of democracy. It doesn't matter whether the mechanisms work or not, or whether you can do a thing within the mechanisms. They thought doing the thing within the mechanisms was a violation of what the whole concept to them was about.
But the other thing is that Gillard got a huge bounce when she came in. There was, you know, it's like on the one hand uncomfortable, on the other hand exciting. It was actually the stuff that happened after that that made people go, maybe the original action was really shonky too. It was because of the campaign, you know, all of that stuff.
I think you take a simplistic approach to comparing Howard's government with the current government, because we have a minority government and you can't just take leadership straight off and go down the path you want to go. They've got to negotiate the outcomes, and I think we need to recognise that when preparing that. I'm not saying this government's wonderful, but I don't think Julia Gillard is operating in the same environment as John Howard was.
I think a lot's made. I mean, I think the thing that's really difficult, different about the environment that she's operating in, I think, is that Abbott's prepared to say anything, and the media's let him get away with saying anything. I don't think that, you know, and that notion that it's actually become entirely impossible, it seems to me, to have a reasonable public discourse about any kind of, even remotely, you know, two-step idea.
Is that the media's fault?
I think, I think absolutely the media's going through a crisis in this country at the moment. The fact that, because, you know, you've gone from a time when journalists would file every couple of days and you had a chance that you might actually develop relationships and connections with people and actually know something about what's going on. They're now having to file every 3 hours, which means, and the only thing that you can get across, you know, that they can get across in any sort of detail in that time is personality stuff. So, you know, the fact that even when political leaders are putting out substance and content, the journalists aren't picking it up because they haven't got time. They just talk about it in terms of the personality manoeuvres. And I think that's about the crisis in the media environment.
The point you made about selling political ideas, and that struck me,
working families, at least
that
someone
that's
not in
so, but so there's a bit of an exclusion in that, because there's that assumption that the family unit is mum, dad and two kids, and we all know from the census that's not true. So somebody hasn't worked that out for some reason.
Well, it's just ridiculous. What about people that aren't working?
Yeah, that's right, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd actually characterise that rhetoric
had
a bit
that
differently.
Inclusive thing, and he always had the broader narrative across the continent. Particular regional narrative, so like sewer in Brisbane was a big issue when well was needed to be done and recognised and actually rolled out and actually happened. And understood more about the regions and what
Sorry.
No, that's all right.
There was a time when the leaders seemed to have destroyed their parties, like Menzies did and Whitlam did to a certain extent. And then everything started to change. But Hawke did as well. We've moved on. I think social media's has fragmented some of the debate. Everyone's a political theorist and a commentator. If you read any of these comments now, it's just incredibly how disappointing informed people are about Australian political history. Mm-hmm. Even 10 years ago, they don't understand some of the stuff that goes on.
Any final comments, just aware of the time?
Sure.
Yeah.
I was going to make a comment on the working families thing. My take on that rhetoric was quite different. My take on that rhetoric is that it's actually about distinguishing between the cafe latte set left and the blue collar left, and that what they were actually seeking to do with that language was they were bringing together the family values language, which is about social conservatism, and the workers language, which is about traditional notions of class, and that they were trying to say they were trying to say we're not Paul Keating.
Segmentation of the market of voters because they thought they had the cafe latte set wrapped up.
Well, the cafe latte set got pissed off with it, let me assure you.
No. Adam Benton, Melbourne says you're absolutely right. it's been a wonderful discussion, but I'm just aware of the time, it's getting a bit late. So I'd just like to thank everyone for coming along, and perhaps you could all thank Lindy for coming along too. And if anyone has any more questions, I'm sure Lindy maybe could stay around for maybe 5 minutes. If you want to continue the discussion, I'm sure she'd be more than happy. But once again, thanks very much.
Thanks.